You get a great loan done with absolute integrity, and you're keeping K-Bright's ministry going by supporting our advertising partner. It's a win-win. Call CenterPoint at 800-600-2115.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Crawford Broadcasting Company, this station, or its sponsors.
Radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for a half hour on weekday mornings, Monday through Friday, from 9:30 to 10 Pacific time. You can call in if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, or if you have an alternate viewpoint you'd like to balance comment and discuss something that you've heard that you think isn't quite right here. We'd be glad to talk to you about that. If you'd like to give me a call, the number to call is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Remember, this program is very short, so don't put off your call. If you want to get in, please call as early as possible. One announcement I have to make, and that is, or I want to make, is that this weekend I will be speaking in Temecula at the Pujol Schoolhouse. This is a place that we have monthly lectures, and only once a month here in Temecula, we have these meetings, which are open to our listeners to come. I've been teaching a series called Strategies for Unity about the need to fulfill the vision of Christ when he prayed that we would all be one. How would that really look? How would that be brought about? What strategies are there to overcome the enemy's attempts to prevent it? Those are the things we discuss, and that's this Saturday night in Temecula. We'd love to have you there. The meeting starts at 6:30, and if you don't know where it is, if you haven't been to the meetings before, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and go to the link that says announcements, and that'll take you right to the place where you can see a map and the address and all the information for this Saturday night in Temecula. Our first caller today is Philip, calling from San Diego. Philip, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, my question is, have you ever studied the Shroud of Turin? And if you have, do you take a position that it could be Christ's burial cloth?
You know, I haven't studied it, although I've watched documentaries on it. And, that's not quite the same thing, because documentaries often have some particular angle they're trying to promote. And so I don't know about the objectivity of what I've heard and seen. I've read, articles and things like that too, but that's been a long time ago. The Shroud has not fascinated me, as it has some people, but I will say this, it seems to me it could be authentic. I don't know, I don't know if it is, and I'm not going to put my stamp of approval on it as authentic, since I certainly am not an expert. But it seems to me not impossible. It's not impossible that it could be authentic, at least in view of the things I've heard and seen and read about it. What is your impression of it?
I find myself about 80% convinced, and the reason I leave 20% for error is I wasn't there, so I could be wrong. But sure. I found the documentaries and the books I've read on it convincing.
Yeah, I mean, if there's not some kind of false propaganda being put out in these things, then it sounds like there are some indicators that there might be something supernatural that brought it into being. And if so, obviously the resurrection of Christ would be a candidate, probably the top candidate, to explain what caused that impression to be found on the shroud. But again, not knowing the science myself, not having seen the thing, and really not needing it for my faith at all. It has been something that I can't, I haven't really had an interest in making a firm statement about it. I don't really, if it were proven or known to be authentic, it wouldn't add anything to my faith because I already know that Jesus rose from the dead. And I know that somewhere there once was a shroud that he was wrapped in. Whether that's it or whether the shroud, the original shroud, has been lost forever, wouldn't make any difference to me in terms of my faith in the resurrection of Christ. If it is authentic, though, of course, it may be one of those things to make unbelievers take notice.
You know, it's been called a fifth gospel by some people.
Well, I don't think it contains really very much information about Jesus. If it is Jesus, it's perhaps the only photographic image of him we could say that we have. But I don't, you know, again, I'm not going to put too much stock in it, but I'm not going to discredit it either.
Thank you.
All right, Philip, thank you for your call. God bless you. All right, our next caller is Jerry, who's calling from Temecula, California. Jerry, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for what you do. I had a question specifically. We've, as of late, had Jehovah's Witnesses knocking on our door, and we don't want to turn them away. We want to point them towards Jesus. And I was just wondering what tact you would use, how we could be the most direct without alienating them in regard to the truth.
Yeah. You know, when I've dealt with Jehovah's Witnesses many, many times, and in a lot of cases it's just been sort of a debate over the meaning of passages of Scripture, especially on the deity of Christ and so forth, which is probably the standard thing that Christians mostly argue with them about. In many cases, I've felt like, you know, you win the debate, but you don't win their soul in any way, and so you wonder what's the point of debating with them. Now, there are times when one of the Jehovah's Witnesses, since they always come in twos, one of them is sometimes a trainee of an older one. Usually, sometimes it's a younger one and an older one together. Or two people about the same age, but one of them is a newer convert to their beliefs and is being sort of mentored or trained in the door-to-door witnessing aspects. And it's often the case that the newer JW who's there, the younger or whatever, is somewhat more open-minded to hearing, you know, solid biblical arguments and answers to the Jehovah's Witness points than the older one is. And if you find that one of them really is interested in, you know, discussing these things, dialoguing, debating them even from the Scripture, and that they really, you know, if you can pick up that they are benefiting from it, then I'm all for, you know, discussing the Trinity, discussing the deity of Christ and so forth, which are the main issues with which we would have theological differences with them. But there's a different issue that I think is even a greater difference I have with them, and that is the thing that makes them a cult. I do believe Jehovah's Witnesses are in a cult. And most Christians would say they're in a cult because they don't believe in the Trinity. Well, of course, if they don't believe in the Trinity, then I believe their theology is bad. But there's been lots of people who don't believe in the Trinity who aren't in a cult. A cult is not defined by believing or not believing the Trinity. A cult is more of a sociological phenomenon where a group of people sort of check their brains at the door and allow some organization or some leader to think for them and to control their thoughts. That's what I would call a cult. And Jehovah's Witnesses certainly are a cult in that respect. They learn how to parrot every line from the Watchtower magazine, which is published by their organization. They're not allowed to read religious literature from other groups, lest they become confused. And this is extremely cult-like. And this is, to my mind, this is even worse than the fact that they don't believe in the Trinity. And some people might say, well, why would that be worse? I'd say it because of this, because the Jews, the disciples who were Jews, when they met Jesus, they did not yet know of any doctrine of the Trinity. The Jews didn't teach a doctrine of the Trinity, and we don't really read of Jesus sitting down and teaching that doctrine either. I believe the disciples came to understand the Trinity as they grew in their knowledge of God, but initially they were not Trinitarian when they began to follow Jesus. They were just Jewish in their theology of God, and that's not Trinitarian. But because they were encouraged to examine Christ for themselves, there wasn't some Pharisee saying, "No, you can't hear what you can't listen to him, you can't read anything about him." If they had someone controlling them so they couldn't think for themselves and making them reject Christ, well, then that would have been a bigger problem than their initial ignorance was, because initial ignorance can be corrected if we're allowed to think and study and research, whereas even a person who does believe in the Trinity might be in a cult of some kind where the pastor or the leader of their group, you know, stifles all free thought. And so even if they have the right view of the Trinity, they may be in a cult and in danger of being controlled by, you know, some human personality. The Jehovah's Witnesses don't believe in the Trinity, and they are controlled by a dominating organization, and they're not allowed to think or question, and that's their problem.
I would address
them personally, rather than just on a doctrinal basis. I would address them personally as individuals and say, you really need to be free to explore all the options here. You need to not get locked into a system that tells you what you're allowed to think and what you're allowed to explore, and get them to think freely. And then, of course, you can present scriptures to them that may be of use to them in changing their minds. But you have to realize what you're dealing with. You're dealing with people who are in kind of a mind control cult, and so you can make great arguments with them and say, "Wow, I blew their arguments out of the water. I won that debate," but you haven't gotten anywhere toward winning them because they're locked into a cult.
I can see alienating them by showing them that they're wrong. You know, winning the argument that's not a good tack to take. You know that. Pointing him to Jesus, and I've even heard using the New World Translation to show them that Jesus is God.
It can be done.
So, anyway, I wanted to. I'll continue praying about that and seeing where the Lord can use us to love them towards the truth. You know.
Maybe spinning
my wheels, but
winning Jehovah's Witnesses is a very difficult thing to do. But sometimes they can be won. I would suggest that you love them, you treat them with respect as human beings, you don't allow them to get away with saying things that are not biblically, responsible. But you speak the truth in love. And you address yourself to their heart and to their mind as well. But I think many times in debates with cultists, we only address their minds and their mental, theological mistakes. A lot of times the problem is their heart is enslaved to an organization. And addressing them as persons from the heart, I think, can often surprise them out of their blindness.
I agree, yeah. Well, very good. That helps, Steve. Appreciate that.
Okay, Jerry. God bless you. Good talking to you.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, our next caller is Grace calling from Westminster, California. Grace, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for being there. And my question is, what do you think about the Bible codes?
Are those still around? I know there's a big...
I doubt it, but I'm still curious.
Yeah, there was a big splash that the Bible Code made back, when was it, in the 90s, when the book came out by that title, and then there were Christian versions of it all. The original Bible Code was not written by a Christian, and then Christians came out with similar books and so forth. The idea of the Bible Code was that if you look at the Bible in the original Hebrew, the Old Testament, and then, of course, Christians would do the same thing in the New Testament, in the original language, that if you'd follow a variable letter sequence, variable interval sequence pattern of some kind between the letters, for example, you go through a passage and you look at every third letter, or every 25th letter, or every 14th letter, or every 30th letter, or something like that, you could take any variable sequence but you go through consistently, go to every fourth letter in the passage and take that letter out and put them all together, it spells out a message. And someone made a big deal about this. I guess it was back in the 90s. I'm trying to think. Was it 90s? Yeah, it was. And to me, it never really impressed me. For one thing, I don't believe that the Bible is written magically. Some people think it was. Secondly, I don't believe we have absolutely unchanged manuscripts. So if we do this with the present manuscripts, we'd have to be assuming that there's been no changes in any way in the manuscripts for this code to work, and that the manuscripts are exactly like the originals, and evidence does not support that likelihood. But the main thing is, I don't know why God would build such a code into the Bible when the biblical message is clear enough, just reading it normally. It reminds me a little bit of a cartoon comic strip I once saw where a DJ, this is back in the, I think in the 80s, back when there was a lot of talk about these heavy metal bands having satanic messages backwardly masked into their records, and if you play them backwards, you'd hear these messages. And in this comic I saw, there's a DJ saying, hey, we're going to find out right now here on the air if this new album really does have satanic messages when we play it backward. We've got it on the turntable. Let's turn it and see what happens. The guy begins turning it with his finger, and the message comes through, worship Satan, hate your parents, kill policemen. And the DJ says, wow, there really are satanic messages right here. And they said, oh, wait a minute, that's going forward. And it's like, you don't need to go backward to get those messages. That's what they say, forward. And it's the same thing with the Bible. You don't need to have some kind of special reading device, a computer, to pick out individual letters to see if there's a secret message in there. The real message is found, just read it straightforward. If you just read the Bible, you'll find out the truth of God. Now, if someone says, well, God put it in there as a sign to prove that his Bible is really miraculous, well, I don't find any hints from Jesus or the apostles that we should be looking for those kinds of signs. And it seems to me, who's dictating what the interval between the letters is supposed to be? If you pick, if you pick some number, like every 13th letter in any document, and you go all the way through it, I'm sure you'll find a few words come out, just out of, by the law of averages. And if it doesn't work with every 13th letter, try every 23rd letter, or every 17th letter, or every 37th letter. If you do this with any lengthy document, I'm sure you're going to get some interesting stuff out of it if you want to. But I don't think that God, wrote the Bible in such a way that it would require the invention of computers to discover, its real supernatural aspects. The real supernatural aspects of the Bible are seen in the prophecies that you find when you read it in a straightforward manner, and you see them fulfilled in history. This happens so much in the Bible that it gives indisputable evidence to anyone who's open-minded and looks at the evidence that this is the Word of God. And we don't need Bible codes. I think Hank Hanegraaff calls the Bible code magic apologetics or something like that. It's probably a good word for it. It's trying to prove the Bible's a magical book, and it's not. It's not a magical book. It's a message from God. And so the Bible code I never bothered to read the book. Someone sent me the book back when it was originally published. You don't hear much about it anymore, but I guess there's still people who think it's pretty sexy stuff.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your view, and I think you've pretty much cured me of it.
Okay, Grace. Yeah, just read the Bible, in English straight through, or whatever, in Greek, if you know Greek. But I wouldn't go looking for variable letter sequences.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, God bless you, Grace. Thank you for calling. All right, our next caller is Tom from Norwalk, California. If you'd like to be on the program, the number is 1-800-227-5278. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. The number is 1-800-227-5278. Tom, thank you for calling. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hello, Steve. I just came across your program about a week ago.
Great.
And I have a question in Jeremiah, especially about the last couple of verses in chapter 22,
uh-huh.
about Jeconiah, Kaniah. where it says, I'll just read the last two verses. It says, a man who will not prosper in his days, for no man of his descendants will prosper sitting on the throne of David or ruling again in Judah. And then I noted, when I read the New Testament, Matthew and Luke, Jesus is in that genealogy. How does that? How could he have a literal thousand-year reign if Jeremiah says no man of this man's descendants will rule again in Judah?
Well, Matthew's genealogy does contain Jeconiah, but Luke's does not.
Okay,
and that's an important thing, because now there's a difference between Matthew's genealogy of Jesus and Luke's, a very big difference. One is that although they both have Jesus descended from David, they don't have him descended from David through the same lines. Matthew's genealogy traces Christ through David's son Solomon and the kings, including King Jeconiah, in Matthew's lineage. And in Luke, it traces Jesus' lineage from David through a different son, Nathan, and not through any of the kings of Judah. So that the genealogy in Luke doesn't include Jeconiah or any of the kings. And so what's the relationship between Matthew's and Luke's genealogies? There's lots of theories about that, but I think the best one is that Luke is giving us Mary's genealogy. And Matthew very clearly is giving Joseph's. Now, Joseph was descended from Jeconiah the king. And therefore, Joseph.
Thinking in Matthew,
Yeah, and therefore, Joseph and anyone biologically descended from him could never be the king in Judah because of the curse on Jeconiah's line that you mentioned in Jeremiah 22. But Jesus was not biologically related to Joseph. He came through his mother Mary, and if Luke is giving us Mary's genealogy, she came from David also, as the Messiah must. But she didn't come she didn't come down through Jeconiah. So the curse on that family was avoided in the case of the biological ancestry of Mary and therefore of Jesus. So he's not received Jeconiah. Yeah. But there's another related question, is then why does Matthew even give a genealogy? You know, since Joseph isn't Jesus' actual father, and Joseph is descended from Jeconiah, you know, why even bother giving us the genealogy? And I think the reason is because Jesus in society, since he was adopted by Joseph, he was the legal heir of Joseph's line. He was officially the oldest son of Joseph, though he wasn't biologically his son. He was adopted.
Right.
And therefore, the lineage of Joseph would provide Jesus, we could say, his legal genealogy, or his official genealogy, though not his biological genealogy. And that being so, Joseph came through the kingly line of the kings of Judah, and as such would have been in line, if not for the curse on Jeconiah's house, would have been in line to be the king in his own generation, possibly, or at least someone, a brother of his or someone would have been. Now, Jesus, of course, has that legal standing in Israel through Joseph, by being Joseph's adoptive son. But he's avoided the curse of the line of Jeconiah by not being biologically related to Joseph. So we have...
Okay, that does make sense. That cleared a lot up for me. It was just very confusing, you know, why, you know, especially when you get to Revelation and trying to add all that together.
All right. Well, I appreciate
that, Yes, that made a big difference. So thank you very much, Steve.
Okay. God bless you, Tom. I appreciate your call. And thanks for listening and calling. Nicole from Colton, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I just have a question about how I read the Bible sometimes. I do this thing where I will open a random page and just go to where my eyes first lead me. And it's kind of, a lot of times, it's exactly what I needed to read. Or, like, I look at it like kind of what God wanted me to speak like them. But I was just wondering if it's dangerous to do that too much, because I get kind of disappointed when it's not something I
thought
I needed to see.
Well, that's not really any way to study the Bible. I think the Bible is not there, again, to be a magic book that gives us a verse for the day by opening randomly from it. It's a message from God. It's a story beginning in Genesis and continuing through Revelation. In the Gospels especially, it's the story of Jesus. And in the epistles, it's the teachings of the apostles about how to live and follow Jesus. Now, these teachings are not, you can't just take one page and understand how the contents of that page fit into the big picture unless you read the whole book, just like any other book. And you go through it and you learn the story. Then the particular meaning and value of the contents of any one verse can be seen in their proper place, and you're better apt to understand how they can be applied to your life. I think that the best way to study the Bible is by reading whole books. Read the whole book of Matthew, the whole book of Romans, the whole book of Galatians, the whole book of, First John or something, even in one sitting if possible, but at least read it all the way through to get the whole picture. But there are times when you can open at random and see something that is relevant, but you'll only know if it's relevant if you know enough about it to know what it's talking about in its context. You need to know the context. You need to study the whole book to know the context of anything. I was once in a very perplexing situation that had to do with a decision I had to make in a relationship, and I didn't open the Bible at random looking for a verse. I just opened the Bible because I was going to start flipping through and look for the last place I'd been reading and continue reading. But where my Bible fell open to was a page that where my eye hit, it had a verse that exactly answered to the issue I had to make a decision about. Now, it wasn't a standalone verse. It was a verse that's in the middle of a teaching on the very subject that I needed to be, my attention drawn to. And so I felt that God, in fact, did direct me to that passage at that moment. I wasn't even looking. I was just going to continue my Bible reading, and I opened my Bible, how you open it just randomly, and then you plan to leaf to the place that you're going to read. And where it opened randomly, where my eye hit, was actually at a verse that directly spoke unambiguously to the issue that I was needing some insight about. So I do think that God can direct you to a passage that's just the passage he wants you to see at that moment. But that's not a good way to study the Bible in general. I think in general we should plan to systematically read through the Bible and study it if possible, and certainly meditate on it day and night. And that's how you get to really know the Bible by heart. So this random turning is not something you should do as a habit, I don't think, but from time to time it may be something God would surprise you with and use. Anyway, I'm sorry I can't go any longer on this. We're out of time. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We're on Monday through Friday doing the same thing. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can do the same from our website, thenarrowpath.com.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of KBRT, its ownership, its management, or its sponsors.
AM 740 is the station that gets families talking to each other.
I have two daughters that listen.
People of all ages need to get spiritually fed, and we've got what you need. The teaching and talk programs people can agree on. But we can only keep the programs on the air when you financially support them.
My youngest daughter's 13. Every time I go in a room, it's on, and it's always such a positive message, and we talk about the meaning and stuff, that are behind them, and it gives us some good dialogue and things to talk about.
Tell your friends about AM 740. K-Bright.
Please tell your friends in San Diego that they can now hear K-Bright programming two places, because AM 1240 has joined AM 740, bringing K-Bright programming to South County.
The Inland Empire's Christian Voice, KBRT and KBRT HD Costa Mesa and KNSN San Diego, also on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled The Fruit of the Spirit. Do you seek God on a daily basis and ask Him to help you be a better person? Yet sometimes it feels like you have not grown at all? That can be frustrating, but know that as a Christian, God has blessed you with spiritual fruit to help you be that better person. It's just that life can sometimes hinder that growth. Know that the deeper you go with God, the more that fruit will grow. So stay tuned as Joyce helps explain what the fruit of the Spirit is and what it means to you. But before she begins, we want to continue to give you the opportunity to show the love of Christ with those who might feel forgotten. To find out what you can do, visit our website at joycemeyer.org/Christmas. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching, The Fruit of the Spirit.
If you want to get along with people, learn to keep your mouth shut. If you want to get along with people, keep your opinions to yourself. Learn how to mind your own business. Come on, I got to fast forward this. I got a lot to say and not much time left. You know how much trouble you can save yourself just by keeping your opinions to yourself? You know how many arguments you can avoid just by listening to the Holy Spirit tell you, don't say that. Just don't go there. You've been there, done that, been around that mountain 1,000 times, just don't go there again. Don't try to control people. People don't like you when you try to control them. Give people the liberty to make their own choices and their own mistakes. Respect people's rights to individuality. Everybody doesn't have to be like you. Help your children be what God wants them to be. Don't try to make them be what you want them to be. Learn how to forgive quickly. Don't be easily offended. And, you know, I've got a 4-part series on every one of these things. But I'm just trying to give you a little quick lesson.